So Jesus walks into the temple, his father's house, and in a fit of anger overturns the tables and chases out the money changers. A lot of Bible scholars have written a lot of things about this scene in the Christian scriptures. They point out that it actually appears in all four of the gospel stories, the different versions of the life and acts of Jesus, which is a relatively uncommon thing. The book of John is different from the other three gospels in a lot of ways, and the way in which this episode is reported is one of those differences. While the other three gospels recount this tale as happening near the end of Jesus' career, right after his return to Jerusalem and shortly before the Pharisees begin to plot to kill him, John reports it as the very first act of his public ministry. John's gospel is the only one that made it into the Bible that shows Jesus using the words, "my father's house," in this story. And it goes on to quote Jesus' reference to his own resurrection, "destroy the temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Some scholars believe it's written this way because the author of John wants to use this story to show Jesus claiming his authority. There are a couple places I want to go with this. First, I went to Sunday school on suburban Long Island, where all the pictures of Jesus in my church showed him looking a lot like me. Light skin, blondish hair, blue eyes. I'm pretty sure that the author of John had a more realistic understanding of Jesus' physical description, which was likely dark skin and hair and eyes. After all, this gospel is estimated to have been written within 3 generations of Jesus' death and near the place where he lived his life. So the answer to the question I'm going to pose varies depending on what one believed Jesus looked like, but it's a good question either way. What does it mean that the person after whom the Christian faith is modeled proves his authority in a fit of anger during his first public appearance? There are many other stories of him proving himself through healing acts and through miracles, but this first story, according to John, is one of authority gained through an action born out of anger. If Jesus is a white man, at least in one's understanding of him, right? We know historically Jesus was not a white man. But if all the pictures in your church are of Jesus being a white man, this story might be used to give some credibility to the idea that the righteous anger of the privileged can support their authority. There's certainly people acting in today's public and political spheres who might believe in the power of this kind of credibility. On the other hand, if Jesus is a dark-skinned man, his claim to authority through righteous anger can be seen as a powerful example of the claiming of power by the oppressed. He could be seen as a model for the liberation movements of past and present times. This is not a new idea. Clearly, anger played a part in the civil rights movement. In his book, Race Matters, the scholar, theologian, and activist Dr. Cornel West calls Malcolm X the prophet of black rage. And he claims that Malcolm, quote, believed that if black people felt the love that motivated that rage, they would affirm themselves as human beings, no longer viewing their minds, bodies, and souls through white lenses, and believing themselves capable of taking control of their own destinies. This is not unlike the idea of chasing the money changers out of the temple. When you think about it, Jesus' anger at the misuse of his father's house was rooted in his love for his father. The relationship between love and anger was explored by Dr. Beverly Wildung Harrison, a scholar and a teacher of Christian social ethics and feminist theory. In her 1981 essay, The Power of Anger in the Work of Love, from which I stole the title for this service, Dr. Harrison wrote, "Anger is not the opposite of love. It is better understood as a feeling signal that all is not well in our relation to other persons or groups or the world around us. Anger is a mode of connectedness to others, and it is always a vivid form of caring, she writes. To grasp this point, that anger signals something amiss in relationship, is a critical first step in understanding the power of anger in the work of love. Where anger rises, there is the energy to act. We must never lose touch with the fact that all serious human moral activity, especially action for social change, takes its bearings from the rising power of human anger. It's what I see happening in today's liberation movement. The anger that has welled up and expressed itself in the Black community and its allies of all kinds in response to police violence and mass incarceration is surely a signal that transformation in relation is needed. In a 2015 online article for The Nation, Michael Denzel Smith writes about Black rage as both a community-building function and a galvanizing force. At its best, he writes, Black rage speaks to the core concerns of Black people in America, providing a radical critique of the system of racism that has upheld all of our institutions and made living Black in America a special form of hell. But that anger, he writes, has not only drawn attention to injustice, it has driven people to action, sparking movements and spurring them forward. At the very least, the public expression of Black rage has allowed communities and people who have felt isolated in their own anger to know that they are not alone. When Black rage is felt, organized, and radically expressed, this is what it does best, he says, shift consciousness and make the needs and concerns of Black America part of the body politic. I cannot imagine that Black people should be anything other than angry today. If you can, I invite you to read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, or attend a march or vigil for Tony Robinson, or visit the county jail. And I cannot, for myself, imagine not being angry with them. What's the old saying? If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention? I've been angry since I started paying attention. And yet, I believe there's a balance that needs to be held here. Margaret Wheatley claims just the opposite of Michael Smith's statement with these words, but just how far can anger carry us, and where do we end up? Anger doesn't give us energy, she claims. It eats away at us and makes us sick. There's no nourishment coming into our bodies such as is so readily available when we feel peaceful, centered, generous. Can both of these things be true? The dynamics of my own relationship between love and anger is very clear to me. My own experiences resonate with Dr. Harrison's assessment that anger is a signal that something with which I'm connected is off kilter. And remember, I'm connected to everything. And that change is needed. And at the same time, that anger can drain me if I'm not taking care not to let it drain me. I think it matters where anger is rooted from. If it's rooted in love, as in the connections made by Malcolm X and by Dr. Harrison, I think anger can have the power to be both nourishing and transformative. It can be a basis for community, although I think it can't be the only basis for community. If it's rooted in love, I think anger can be a powerful motivator to make change. If I'm angry about someone I care about, someone I'm connected with, if I'm angry about how they are being treated, I'm pretty likely to try to do something about it. But if it's rooted in fear, well, as Yoda says, fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. We have the whole two sets of trilogies at our house and have been watching them incessantly. Parker Palmer, the Quaker teacher and author, says more or less the same thing in his book about civil discourse in public life, which is called Healing the Heart of Democracy. He writes, "If you've ever loved someone or something, you probably know what it means to have your heart broken by failure, loss, betrayal, decline, death. Like most Americans," he writes, "I love democracy. And like many I know, it breaks my heart when democracy is threatened from within or without. Diminishments and losses of the heart are among life's painful experiences, and heartbreak is the most honest word I know for that pain." He continues, "But pragmatic Americans have a hard time naming and claiming things of the heart when it comes to public life. Instead of saying, 'I'm heartbroken about whatever it is that threatens our version of the American dream,' acknowledging our wounds and thus opening them to healing, we withdraw into the silence of private life, or we express ourselves with the cynicism and the anger that make the public realm toxic, producing more psychodrama than social change." He continues, "There are exceptions, of course. Some of the cynicism, anger, and hatred we hear is scripted and strategic. For example, manipulating our," and he wrote this years ago, "for example, manipulating our ancient fear of otherness is a time-tested method to gain power and to get wealthy if you have a public megaphone." I'm not sure how or even if this analysis works, if it can be applied to black rage, either historic or current. Maybe heartbreak also has something to do with black rage, especially if it's rooted in love. But I don't want you to hear that I believe that African Americans should be asked to open their wounds to healing. I believe that African Americans should determine for themselves what they need to heal. And I don't believe that society should be trying to diminish black rage, because I believe it's completely justified and appropriate. Amen. The work of acknowledging wounds and opening them to healing is something I believe I can benefit from. And maybe it's something that other white folks who want to be allies or co-conspirators in the movement can benefit from. For myself, I'm learning that anger still eats at me, but only when it comes out of fear or if I'm holding on to it for too long. Then it really does keep me from functioning at my best. I see myself a little bit like Ralphie in the movie A Christmas Story, as he lives in fear of Scott Farkas, the town bully with the yellow eyes. Ralphie is a young boy growing up in Northwest Indiana, and his adventures and fantasies make up a good part of this movie. But in reality, Scott picks on Ralph and his friends throughout this movie. And one afternoon, Scott hits Ralphie with a snowball and then says, "Come here," presumably so he can beat him up. But to the astonished delight of his friends, something in Ralphie snaps. And he charges Scott, and he knocks him to the ground, and he starts hitting him. And he doesn't just hit him, but he's wailing on him, and he's wailing and swearing the whole time. Ralphie's little brother runs, and he gets their mom, who gets there and starts calling Ralphie's name, and he doesn't hear her. He doesn't even hear her at first. He is so wrapped up in this overwhelming anger. So she pulls him off Scott, and he looks at her completely befuddled. And then he bursts into tears. Ralphie held on to that anger for so long that it finally exploded out of him in a tidal wave of cussing and hitting. And when that was interrupted and he was brought back to himself, he was overwhelmed by the hugeness of it and how it took over. Anger is a... That is awesome. Anger is a strong, strong emotion. It can be a very powerful force. It can lead us into actions that alienate us from each other, and it can lead us into actions that draw us together in common cause. It can move us to passionate response against injustice, and it can bring us into protest. And if Dr. Harrison is right, it can also be something that increases our own self-awareness and our compassion, as well as our contribution and our connection to community. I've been using a lot of other people's words today because they're just so eloquent on this. I'm going to close with some words of wisdom from C. Joybel See, a contemporary American poet. She writes, "Anger is like flowing water. There's nothing wrong with it as long as you let it flow. Hate is like stagnant water, anger that you denied yourself the freedom to feel, the freedom to flow, water that you gathered in one place and left to forget. Stagnant water becomes dirty, stinky, disease-ridden, poisonous, deadly. That is your hate. On flowing water travels little paper boats of forgiveness. Allow yourself to feel anger, allow your waters to flow along with all the paper boats of forgiveness. Be human. May it be so, and may we be so."